It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Residents of Superior were allowed back into their homes this morning after a fire and a round of explosions at the Husky Energy oil refinery yesterday. There were no reported fatalities, but a number of people were injured and taken to area hospitals. Here's Jim Payne, the mayor of Superior, speaking today.
It took many, many hands putting this together and making sure that there were zero fatalities, that the injuries that were sustained there were small in number and were treatable. Everybody's going home right now. In one of the largest disasters this community has ever seen, everybody is going home the next day.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you are part of this story or near this story, are you in or near Superior? Were you yesterday? Did you hear or feel the explosion, see the smoke plume? Did you evacuate yourself? And what questions do you have as you make your way back home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Kading is a reporter for WPR News in Superior. She's following this story. Danny, thanks for joining us on this again.
Hi, Rob.
So what ended up happening? How many evacuations were there, and when did they come to an end, Danny?
Well, the evacuation was put in place mid-afternoon yesterday after they realized that the fire had reignited at the refinery initially after they had received reports of a small tank explosion earlier in the morning. They said that they were able to put that fire out and that the scene was stable, but then afternoon that fire reignited, and so they were watching weather patterns and wind in the area because the fire was around some product that they were concerned about. One of those tanks contained hydrofluoric acid, according to Douglas County's Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler. So they ended up evacuating a portion of the city, mostly South Superior. They evacuated 10 miles south of the refinery and an area 6 miles wide, and that lasted through the night until 6 a.m. this morning when that evacuation order was finally lifted.
And UW-Superior ultimately ended up evacuating too, is that right?
Yeah, actually we got kicked out of our station yesterday afternoon around 4 or 5 o'clock because we were all of a sudden in the evacuation zone. So yeah, all of the students and people who were in the affected area were advised to go from UW-Superior to the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center in Duluth. And then that served as a temporary shelter for those who needed it.
And classes at local schools in UW-Superior, did I hear this right, they ended up being canceled today?
Yes, they were canceled today. The students were allowed to return to the residence halls as of noon today, but the Superior School District canceled classes as well as Northwestern and Maple. And so, you know, they had made this decision yesterday when the evacuation order was in place because they wanted to play it safe in case anything were to happen. And those tanks were to let go, they wanted to make sure people were out of the area.
You told us yesterday about some potentially dangerous chemicals there if those tanks had caught fire. What are officials saying now about air quality today?
Well, they set up air quality overnight, and they had teams from the refinery and the US EPA who were conducting air quality monitoring and preliminary reports from that. And what we're hearing this morning at a press conference are that there's no reason to be concerned, that they're finding very low trace levels of volatile chemicals or dust or particulates from the smoke from that fire. And so there's nothing that they say is raising any concerns or any or poses any health risks. However, for first responders or people who are near the refinery right now, they are wearing personal monitor alarms to alert them if any of those concentrations do get into the a zone where they may need to take some precautions and leave the area. But right now we're hearing that the air quality looks good from the US EPA. They're continuing to do monitoring. And there's also people there who are doing water quality sampling. According to Superior's Fire Chief Steve Panger, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is looking at water quality today.
At the refinery itself, is the fire completely out now?
The fire is completely out. Yes, there was another small fire that broke out later in the evening, but as far as we know, everything was secure. As of 8:15 this morning, the Superior Fire Chief said that the scene was secure and that everything looked good. However, it still remains pretty hot, You know, you're dealing with fuels out there, so the temperatures can reach several thousand degrees, he said. So they're monitoring it for the next 24 hours because they want to make sure that they're there if there is another flare-up.
Now, as we've heard, thankfully no fatalities reported at this fire, these explosions. Some people were did go to the hospital. Do we have any updates on the people who were injured in this?
From the people that were injured, we're told by Essentia Health spokeswoman Maureen Tallarico that they had at least 16 people who were treated for injuries related to the fire at the refinery yesterday. One of those individuals sustained some serious injuries from the blast, but was last reported in good condition. There's a lot of conflicting numbers out there right now, but that's what we have from the Twin Ports Area Hospital.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior, about the Husky Refinery fire and explosions yesterday and the aftermath. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, especially if you've experienced this yourself. Were you evacuated yesterday in the Superior area? Do you have family or friends who were working at the refinery? Call in and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll look at what's coming up next in this story, what kind of investigations now are going to be underway. Danielle Kading will bring us up to date on that. We continue our conversation about the refinery fire in Superior yesterday. Danielle Kading is with us, WPR reporter based there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in the area? Did this affect you? Did you see the smoke plume? Do you or someone you know work at that refinery? 800-642-1234, or let us know if you were evacuated. We'll go to our callers now. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question for you and Danielle in regards to why, in light of, you know, terrorism and the protesting against Line 3, why does the city of Superior and the state of Wisconsin allow Stinson Avenue to run a public road right through the refinery? Why is that Homeland Security not shut that road down years ago?
Tom, thanks for the call. Danielle, I don't know if anybody's looked into that, but is that true? There's kind of a public access or a public road that runs right through the refinery area?
There is a road that runs along it on the north side, and along it there's Stinson Avenue and Hill Avenue. There are a number of businesses on Hill Avenue, and also if you go along Stinson Avenue, that's where the refinery and the Enbridge terminals are. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin did comment about how close it was to the facility, and she noted this morning when she visited Superior that, you know, it was built in the 1950s and 1951, so they probably weren't thinking about residential areas at that time. It definitely is close to the city. I don't know if I can comment on why as to the layout of it. It's an industrial area.
Thanks for that call. I want to look at what happens now, Danielle. You shared some audio from Colin Shady, refinery manager at Husky Energy, talking about what cleanup is going to look like there.
From a cleanup standpoint, certainly the first thing we have to do is get in and do an assessment. We need to really understand what we have to work with, and from there we will use the employees, you know, as a workforce, and also as we typically have in the past, we do use a fair amount of the Superior contractors.
Do we have, Danny, any kind of timeline on when that cleanup really gets going and how long it might take?
Well, the cleanup has started today. The U.S. EPA is there along with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Dave Morrison, who I mentioned before, he's the federal on-scene investigator. He said that there are a number of things that they're considering with the environment there, basically that they are watching for residual oil or firefighting product or sheens that might be running from the refinery in ditches down through Newton Creek or to the Hog Island Inlet. The U.S. Coast Guard set up a boom yesterday to catch any of that product, and they're going to be cleaning that up and putting that into frac tanks to make sure that that's not affecting the environment. So that's one of the things that they're doing today. As the refinery manager noted, they're assessing the situation at the refinery and where things are at before they really get into the cleanup and the incident investigation. Although the U.S. Chemical Safety Board has deployed a four-person team to the city, and they will be investigating things like appropriate federal or state regulations that would apply to how this refinery operates. And they're also going to look at if there's any gaps in how those laws are applied to the operations of the refinery. And then they're going to look at, in terms of safety, you know, they're going to do a safety analysis of whether there's anything there and how they were conducting their operations that could be shared as a lesson with the industry as a whole. And it could be another 12 to 18 months before the board issues any kind of report on their investigation. And then you have the OSHA investigation related to worker safety. As we noted before, about 16 people were treated at the hospital for injuries. But, you know, the refinery manager has said all of their workers are accounted for. They've reached out to the families. But still, they're going to be doing an investigation to look at worker safety, and that could take that could last over the next 6 months.
And the refinery had changed hands as recently as, I think, last year. And under the previous owner, do I have this right, there had been some OSHA violations?
Yeah, in 2015, Calumet, the former owner, was fined around $21,000 for emergency response and flammable liquids violations. They were marked as settled, and those problems were noted as resolved, according to OSHA. And the OSHA is saying that it was the only enforcement action taken against the refinery when it was run by Calumet. But then again, Calumet prior was owned by Murphy Oil. So, you know, again, this refinery was built in 1951. It was owned by Murphy Oil from 58 until it was purchased by Calumet in 2011.
As we wrap up, Danny, now that the evacuations are over, apart from the refinery site itself, does it feel like life is back to normal in Superior?
I think people are glad to be returning to their homes. I think there was some concern this morning about whether it was actually safe to do that, and they, the emergency officials here in town were trying to encourage people that, yes, you can go back to your homes. Some feedback that we've gotten from residents in the community is that they feel like the school districts did a good job as far as getting notices out. And parents, you know, took their kids out of school, and things were kind of congested yesterday. But by all accounts, I think people are glad that what happened yesterday wasn't more tragic than what it was.
Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR reporter Danielle Kading. She's been covering the Husky Oil refinery fire in Superior. She was here to give us the latest details. If you're familiar with Lydia Bastianich, you probably know her for her long-running cooking show on public TV, her focus on Italian cuisine and culture. Maybe you know her from her many cookbooks or restaurants around the country. Now, for the first time, she's sharing the full story of her life, from growing up behind the Iron Curtain in the former Yugoslavia, fleeing to a refugee camp in Italy, arriving in the United States, cooking for two popes, and more. She says she couldn't be more grateful to the U.S. for her new life and the opportunities that came with it. Lydia Bastianich is the host of the public television show Lydia's Kitchen. Her new memoir is titled My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Pleasure being here.
So you were a child. Borders had just changed after World War II. Your family, your Italian family, found itself in now communist Yugoslavia. Can you talk about your life growing up there?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I was born in Istria. Istria is a little peninsula that now actually is in Croatia. But if you look up in the northeast of Italy, right across the Adriatic, there's a little piece of Venice, is this little peninsula. And that was all Italian territory. And of course, as you said, after World War II, it was given as part of the Paris Treaty, it was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia. I was just born at that time, and things changed really drastically and fast. The Iron Curtain went up, our names were changed. We couldn't speak Italian, we couldn't go to church. My father, who was a businessman, had two trucks. They were taken away. He was put to jail for being a capitalist and so on. You know, really oppressed on living a free life. And we had to sort of get into the rhythm of communistic rule and dogma.
You've talked in your book and on the show in the past about some bright spots in your life then, and a lot of them have to do with food and your grandmother. Can you talk about that?
Yes, Rob. I think, you know, my mother was a teacher, an elementary school teacher, and the city that I was born is now Pula, was Pola. But my grandmother lived about 5 kilometers off in a little town called Busoler, one road with houses on both sides. And my mother had the mindset to put us with grandma so that we wouldn't feel the oppression, the difficulties. So I grew up in a courtyard with chickens, with goats, with ducks, with rabbits. We had 2 pigs every year. Grandpa made olive oil, wine. We had a garden. I would help grandma harvest the potatoes, the wheat, and all of that. So for me, it was an idyllic kind of child's situation with nature, within nature. And I remember just the beautiful relationship that I had with grandma and with all of those animals and the food that we produced and that I helped her to I was the runner, let's put it that way.
And that started a theme throughout your life. I think anybody who's watched you or read your books knows this to be true. It's never just about food with you. It's never just food. It's memories and connections and people.
Well, Rob, you know, in about 9 years after, my parents decided to try to get away from this. And of course, they wouldn't let the whole family go. We had relatives on the other side of the border in Trieste. So my mother, my brother and I got the visa to go and visit supposedly a sick aunt. My father was not given the visa. He had to remain because they knew that the whole family would not come back. So as children, we were not told that. We just went to Trieste. We thought we were going to come back. But after 2 weeks, my father came at the door. He escaped literally, physically walking over the border and avoiding the dogs and the shoot. They shot at him and whatever. And, the reality was that we were not going to go back. And, in years after, thinking about, you know, why is my connection to that place? Why is my connection to food so strong? I realized that, you know, not knowing that I wasn't going to come back, I had unfinished business. I had not said goodbye to grandma, to my animals, to my friends. And in a way, food became my connector. I loved cooking the dishes that grandma cooked, the smell, reproducing the smells that I recall with grandma. And all of that kind of gave me comfort and kept me in contact. And it seems that, you know, my whole life is connected to that, you know, using food, enjoying to sort of connect with food and sharing emotion and food and love with the family and with the people.
And then your family had escaped from Yugoslavia and you and your family were literally refugees. You stayed at a refugee center for a couple of years, I think. What was that like?
Right. So, you know, my father was without papers and our visas were ending. Had they caught us, they could have repatriated us. So my parents decided to go to the police and register as refugees. And in turn, they put us in a political refugee camp. San Saba is the name. Now it's a museum. If anybody goes to Trieste, certainly they can visit it. And before the refugee camp, it was a Nazi concentration camp. So it was a dreary place. I remember, you know, going the first kind of time that I went in there and it felt so oppressive. It felt so dark. It smelled of humidity. I still recall all of those kind of emotions. But we stayed there for 2 years awaiting an opportunity to migrate someplace in the world. And for my parents, America was the destination of choice. But, you know, whoever would have asked for us or whoever would have given us the visa. And it just happened that in 1958, Dwight Eisenhower was the president, and he opened the immigration for immigrants, refugees fleeing communism.
What did that mean for you as a refugee yourself, your family, when you got the word, when you came over to the United States?
Oh my goodness, when they first heard it was, you know, was a fiesta, festivities, you know, all excited. Oh, we're going to go to America. My brother and I, you know, we were kids. I was 12, he was 14. And we had seen photos of New York, of America, you know, the music certainly. And we were so excited, but my parents too. I think they were very sort of alleviated because there was no future in that camp. They didn't know, it was uncertainty. And being a parent and having two children and feeling so uncertain, not having a home for them, not having, are they going to go to school? Are they going to go? So everybody was really elated. And in 1958, the Catholic Relief Services and the Red Cross brought us to the United States. And, you know, here we had nobody. We did not speak the language. We didn't have any money. So it was all through the goodness of the government and all of these associations that kind of got us settled, our beginning in America.
Talking to Lydia Bastianich, her new memoir is My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. Lydia, how did you go from, you know, you're a refugee kid now in New York, how did you get into restaurants?
Well, Rob, you know, I came, as I said, 12, began school, and slowly, you know, I cooked even at home. I continued to cook along the way, sort of to even in when I was in the camp, I was going out to school, and they put me in the kitchen, in the nuns' school, in the kitchen to help. So when I came to the United States, as soon as I could, I cooked for the family because the parents worked late trying to make extra money. But also I began asking for side job. One of my first side jobs was in a bakery, Walker's Bakery, Christopher Walken. We are still friends. And, you know, things kind of happened. But, you know, there's an energy. Here we were. This, we had to make it now. You know, this is going to be our home. We can put roots here. I can feel stable here. I can feel comfortable. Nobody's going to persecute me. And all of this as a young child, you know, it generates a kind of go out and do it attitude, you know, make it happen. So, you know, learning English as fast as we could, being great in school, because that all meant, you know, really assimilating and kind of almost wanting to be really accepted by a country. And you know, you really are accepted when you're at your best. And this was a continuous, I think, kind of energy that drove me from school on. I met eventually my husband, who was in the industry, and he was an immigrant. He was a maitre d' in a restaurant in New York, and he wanted to open a restaurant. And then we opened a little 9-table restaurant. I was good at cooking, but I wasn't a chef. We hired a chef. I became the sous chef for 9 years, and I really honed my skills. We went back to Italy, and I went in all the cuisines of Italy with the chefs in Italy to learn, to really hone my skills. And in the first restaurant we opened was in 1971. We had two restaurants. After 9 years, we sold those, and we opened Felidia on 58th Street in Manhattan. And that's when I became the chef. And I became the chef. So the first restaurants had Italian-American cuisine, which is a delicious cuisine, but it's not the cuisine of Italy. Italy has a regional cuisine. So in 1981, when I opened Felidia and I became the chef, I said, I'm going to cook the food of the regions of Italy, 20 regions and all kinds of food. And that, I think, what brought everybody's attention. What is this woman chef, Italian, and what kind of Italian food is she cooking? So Rob, that's when the press became interested. Julia Child came to visit me, James Beard. And, you know, these are the opportunities that this great country really offers. You know, there's a curiosity of somebody, if somebody's doing something good and new. And, you know, I wasn't going to let one thing slide by. I just was so grateful, so happy, so full of wanting to do things because.
And you write throughout your book, your faith, your Catholic faith has been important to you. It was repressed in Yugoslavia. Ultimately, you hit a point where you've cooked, well, not for one, but for two different popes in your career.
Oh my God, Robert, you know, when I never thought, I mean, you know, two, not one, I still, now I think about it, two popes, my God, who gets a chance to cook? And yes, indeed, I had that great honor. And, you know, it just brought me closer. You are right, you know, I returned to my faith as a young child, really knowing that the faith was there, was ours, but we weren't allowed to practice it. And then I just took it back wholeheartedly. And yes, being spiritual and believing and having faith is a big element in my being who I am, in my raising my family, in what I do. There's always a consciousness of that. You know, as far as the popes, one would wonder, Lydia, how did you get picked? Well, Rob, you know, coming in a certain part of my career, I felt the need to give back. And so I still do a lot of charitable events, fundraising events. At the, for 10 years, I worked at the United Nations with UNIFEM, the United Nations Female Organization, which is an international, specifically aiding women and mothers in third world countries. And I would do this big fundraisers at the delegates' dining room at the UN. And, of course, the Vatican has its representative at the UN. And we met each other. Monsignor Celestino Migliori was his name, I recall. And he asked me to do some things. But when the Pope was to come, he said, Lydia, you know, the Pope is coming. Would you cook for him? And I jumped. I said, of course I would. But, you know, I never thought it would happen. But it did. And not only did I cook for Pope Benedict, which was, you know, initially, I must say, you know, I just didn't know how to approach the but you know what happens, Rob? I think food is the ultimate equalizer. When I cooked the food and we got the recipes, you know, back and forth with the Vatican, the menu, all of that. And then I got in the kitchen. Now, the popes, when they come, especially when they come to New York, that is, they do not go to hotels. They stay in the nuncio's, which is the representative nuncio's house. And they eat there and they sleep there and then they go around and do what they have to do. So I, and with my team, moved into the nuncio's house and we were downstairs cooking. The Pope was sleeping upstairs. It was like family. And it was just extraordinary.
And Lydia, we're just about out of time. I wanted to ask, you have gone back to visit that refugee center, the place you lived. It was a former a concentration camp. What was your emotion like? You've been through all this. You've lived this American dream going back to that place.
It was, you know, I couldn't go back. I went back to Trieste before I could get myself to go back to that camp. It took about four visits back. Then I found the courage to go. And, you know, it was just choking me. And to see, it's now all kind of empty and gutted from a fire, whatever. But just all those memories of all those people huddled in those corners, they all flooded back to me. And, you know, the anguish, the tightness of you know, throat that one feels, especially as a child, you know, when you hold back your tears or whatever, it all came back to me. And, you know, I can't help even, you know, to think about the situation in today's world. You know, we were the kind of, those children, when I see them on television, it just brings all that back to me. And I say, you know, the life keeps on going, and sometimes we don't learn, do we?
Lydia, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Lydia Bastianich, host of the public TV show Lydia's Kitchen, author of a bunch of cookbooks, Order of Restaurants, and we've been talking about her new memoir. It's called My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food.